All right.
Good. This is an interview by the University Archives and Special Collections, IIT, being conducted on the 19th floor of the IIT Tower with retiring Vice President for External Affairs, David Baker. In attendance is myself, Ralph Pugh, University Archivist, Adam Strom, Director of University Archives and Special Collections, and of course, Mr. Baker as well. So it's good to be here, and thank you for consenting to do this interview. Our opening question for you to get things rolling is more of a fact-based question. Please describe the organization and mission of your unit when you arrived here, or your area of responsibility, and how did things evolve under your leadership or in response to external developments and influences?
Well, my role here has many, many facets, and really is divided into three major chronological areas. The first role I played was executive director of the National Commission for IIT from September of 93 until May, I think, of 95, somewhere in that time frame. And that role was particular to helping President Lew Collins and the leadership of the university set a new course, imagine a new course for the university. Then in 95, I was appointed Vice President of External Affairs, and in that capacity, I had government affairs, community affairs, mm-hmm. and public relations, as it was called at that time, under me.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's probably documented in different places, but what was the mix of private stakeholders and governmental and IIT stakeholders in the National Commission?
We were organized around a 3-3-3 concept. So we had seven outsiders, we had seven trustees, and we had seven faculty members.
All right.
Under the leadership of Bob Galvin, who was the chairman.
All right. And so that piecing up of the pie remained the same pretty much through the entire formal life of the commission?
Yes.
All right. Did the commission disband formally at any point, or is it?
Yes, it disbanded with its final report to the board in May of, I think it was, well, it's either February or May of 95.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hmm. Yeah, might be a good
point. So I have a third phase. The third phase of my career was in 2001. I was given responsibility by the president of evaluating concept of developing a technology park on the south end of the campus in buildings that were going to be released by the IT Research Institute when we sold off the assets to the employees to create the Alliant, a private
mm-hmm.
firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given the job of raising the money, coming up with the concept, and then building the park and running it. So that was a 15-year period, and I was considered myself the executive director from about 2006 until 2016 when I stepped down. Because I was asked to come back and run marketing and communications back in November for the kind of mm-hmm, restoring mm-hmm. my old job mm-hmm. that I had back in the late 90s.
All right. Okay. Feel free at this point to offer more anecdotes from the National Commission or any part of that.
Sure. Well, yeah. I think that the National Commission was really... I saw as a turning point in the experience of the trajectory of the university, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Although it didn't point up for a while. When I came here in 93, Lew Collins was faced with a really very difficult situation where it wasn't clear what the business proposition was for the university. Because we'd been steadily leaking undergraduates, and then it became a torrent. In 93, we only had something like 237 freshmen. In 90. So things were really difficult for the university then, and competitively. So the National Commission was created with number one, a view towards bringing together a really smart group of people to think mm-hmm. about whether the university should even continue. And in fact, that was the mission created by Bob Galvin, mm-hmm. who funded the commission, by the way.
Yeah.
He gave $500,000 to the university to pay for me and a secretary mm-hmm. to staff it and to pay for the mm-hmm. activities.
Yeah.
So it was you know, both a very difficult time, but then a time where we were free to think about what the future was. When Bob said, well, maybe we should, the purpose of this group is to see whether we should go out of business. You know, that was that difficult a time for us.
Yeah.
And so I was charged with bringing together a process, implementing a process that would, over a period of about 16 months, evaluate that question and look at all aspects of the institution, and then place bet, to the extent it turned out, to place bets on certain new strategies designed to save the university. That was one view. Okay, content of what should we do differently that would make us more competitive in the academic marketplace. The second piece of that was to prove to Bob Galvin and Bob Prisker that indeed we did have a future worthy of their support. And they, because they were both on the commission, they agreed. And that's when that led to the each committing $60 million in the challenge campaign in 1996 that led to the successful
$270 million
first time ever, only last time, first and last time that we made the above the fold in the Chicago Tribune. So that was it was an exciting time, and out of that, the recommendations in the campaign, the key recommendations of the commission were, number one, was to create a unique or a more competitive and distinctive undergraduate program that, and that was framed in creation of the interprofessional project program. So that happened in, the first prototype was the fall of 95. The second component of that was the creation of the Camrus program to attract high quality students, basically buy those students, and to prove that we could attract high quality students to this campus. And that also started in the fall of 95. The second, the third big recommendation was to stay and rebuild the campus. If we got support from government and the private sector, that's what the recommendation was. And I was basically, you could frame my whole career after that. It was my job to make that recommendation real.
All right.
And it was a good way of kind of saying it. You know, although I also was a leader, or as a staff person, I helped with the foundation and the implementation of IPRO too. But then the other big recommendation there that came out of it was to go international, and that led to the explosion in our international graduate programs.
Going back a bit, Mr. Galvin was chairman of the board here from, I think, 1979 onward, so he's already been on board in a responsible position for some time. At the point when he's shepherding the National Commission forward, can you speak to the issue of how, it sounds like in one sense he was very executive, let the experts do the evaluating and move forward and then provide him with a report, but what was your sense of his feeling and the prospect of the university at the point that he is providing the $500,000 grant? Is he really
First of all, let's roll back a little bit. So in the late 80s, starting I think 87 under that our erstwhile president that was only here for a few years.
Myron Feldberg. Yeah.
We launched a campaign in 1987, and the Pritzker and Galvin both declined to make lead gifts from Feldberg, and he then left the university. He saw the handwriting on the wall; it wasn't going to work. So he walked on us, you know. And after 18 months, and Henry Linden then became interim president. This was before I came to the university. And Galvin, meanwhile, in 90, he led, I don't know if he led the search for the new president, because we needed a permanent president. And they looked at two internal, in the end they looked at two internal candidates, and one was our provost and the other was Lou Collins, who was at that time the dean of the School of Law. They picked Lou in 90, and at the same time Galvin, who was anticipating retirement from Motorola, he retired in 91, stepped down as chair of the board in 90, and Pritzker took over. So Galvin was no longer on the board, he was on the executive committee and the policy committee, as they called it. So Lou basically working behind the scenes with a guy named Bob Nelson, who was a consultant, a financial consultant, or a fundraising consultant, used to be the head of institutional advancement for the university in the 60s. Mm-hmm. He was hired then to think about the next campaign, mm-hmm. and in that process to deal with the why the two Bobs, as we call them, refused to make that commitment to the university mm-hmm. in the late 80s.
All right.
So the National Commission was born out of that urgency mm-hmm. to convince our two great benefactors. I mean, both of them were looking at two billionaires, you know, even then,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. which we were very lucky to have, but yeah. but unfortunately they basically had lost faith in the institution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
but not so far as to be willing to set up this commission and to,
yeah,
to
one
put
last
money
shot.
Down. Yeah.
One last shot,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah. All right.
And, of course, I was greatly attracted to coming here with the idea that I could work for Bob Galvin, you know, because we held him, all of us in the business community, held him in such high regard.
Yeah, yeah.
And he really was an amazing leader. He was a guy who, in the course of the conversation, let everybody talk.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would listen. You think he's falling asleep, but then he would come up and say yeah. such wise things and bring all the conversation together.
Yeah. Sounds like a real exciting time for you, because this is perhaps, I would assume or think that maybe the most exciting time you had here, because this is the real reformative period of the university, and that what you're doing is going to make a real difference to hundreds of thousands of people in terms of whether this institution.
Well, you know, I just
or didn't you see yourself as that?
No, I was just running the process at
okay.
the time.
You know? Right.
I, you know, for me, what I recall from that time was the learning very quickly the complexity of working in higher education. And I remember thinking of this as kind of a, coming here as kind of a cushy retirement job, you know, and finding mm-hmm. out just the opposite, that I had no understanding of what it like meant to work with tenured faculty members. And I was just astounded at what they would say to each other, you know, because they could,
mm-hmm.
more than the administration.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and it was a touchy time because the faculty was so dismayed at the decline of the institution, the proud institution that had been in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and to watch it go downhill in the 80s, I'm sure they were all feeling very nervous about its future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, no, my heady time really was mm-hmm. in the period from 2000 to 2010 when I was, well, or starting with the two, you know, starting with, I guess, 99 when I started to pull the money in from the government to support the transformation
right.
of the main campus. That was really
okay. In terms of what you were able
to
really make a difference. And at that point, you're definitely committed to the university for the rest of your operative career.
Well, as long as the president would have me, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, I served at the pleasure of the president. So
mm-hmm.
when Lou Collins prepared to step down, I fully expected that I would retire then, which would have been about at 65.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am now, almost 74. I'm still here, so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, back to the...
This is
yes. Back to the mid-90s, when was the turning point? When, was it as late as 1996 when the two Bobs pledged the money? Were you kind of, was the university in limbo up to that point to a certain degree? Or as soon as the commission is up and functioning and you're moving forward,
the
greater confidence? Because obviously so many things are being laid out in 93, 94.
Yeah, so it was really, you know, the implementation plan. Lou, we did a couple of things that were, Lou orchestrated all this, and I was his handmaiden kind of a thing. So the first thing that happened is we had to convince the board that we were serious about transforming the institution and not just leaking money and slowly dying. So in February of 1995, and the board basically held its feet to the fire in the fall of 94 as the recommendations were kind of being worked on. You know, we provisionally presented the recommendations in the fall of 94, and then we immediately went to work on how to implement them.
Mm-hmm.
So in I remember over Christmas of 95, Lou Collins called upon the College for Architecture to come up with creative new ideas of how to revitalize the main campus, because the main campus mm-hmm. was absolutely dead in the water, had not had a new building. You know, the last new building was 72.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like a dead zone. There was no, you know, parking lots down the middle of the campus, park cars all over the place, no trees, no nothing. I mean, it's just amazing to think of. The buildings were here, but it was just devastating, a devastating visual experience for people.
Mm-hmm.
And we were surrounded by public housing at that time, completely surrounded, and feeling the pressure. I mean, we were fine. Everybody was safe on the campus, but all around us were not so safe. So he brought this group of faculty members, and they worked in teams over the Christmas break to come up with alternative visions for how to stimulate the energy, you know, life on the campus while not disturbing the Meesian heritage, because they were all Meeseans anyway, you know. So they really looked at what we could do around the campus, and came up with a bunch of ideas, mainly focused on the east side of campus in terms of new dorms and things like that. And that then led to one of our great trustees, Charlie Shaw, who was a major developer here in town, to give us a deeply discounted 7-day consultancy with the Urban Land Institute that occurred in March of 95 that I Leroy Kennedy and I staffed, and I think I've got the document right there, of the background material. They did a short little study that basically said the campus isn't worth anything
unless IT is here.
Yeah, you remember that.
Yeah.
And so that then rolled right into the master plan for that Dirk Lahan did. And, and the key to that in terms of Bob Galvin was that Bob was driven nuts by how bad the place looked. And he hated the fact that the L made so much noise. And he just couldn't see how, you know, he had moved Motorola. He considered his greatest gift to the Motorola was moving them to Schaumburg out of the city. So at that time, you know, the prevailing wisdom was still that it's best to have the corporate headquarters in the suburbs on a beautiful suburban rural campus. You know, now it's just the opposite. They're all moving back downtown again.
But yeah, right. Back in the mid-90s, though.
So that was his thing. As the fundraisers and Lou listened to him in the course of the commission debate. That was driving him. And in Bob Pritzker's case, he was driven by the fact that we didn't really have very high quality undergraduate students. We the SAT level scores, the ACT scores were just a bottom feeder in terms of students and faculty, which must looking for a much higher order of student than what we were which were showing up in the admissions process because we were so non-competitive. So they came up with, he and the head of fundraising came up with the idea of the cameras program, the pilot, and Bob Pritzker then gave us a whole bunch of money to test it, and we did a national advertisement in Time Magazine. This happened in the summer of 90, spring, summer 95, or fall, spring of 95 for the fall class of 96, and lo and behold, we got these 30 kids, these 35 kids come here, free ride. But in and the so that then kind of solidified Pritzker's support, and in the case of Bob Galvin, it was Dirk Lohan's master plan that built that put a pretty picture of a campus center that you know protected the academic campus from the L. It's not the one we did, but it's but it basically created a vision that Bob Galvin could imagine being successful. And I've always felt that, I've always thought of those as the two distinguishing things. I'm sure that their decision to commit was much deeper than that, but nonetheless, it was a culminating signal, I think, of rebirth. Academic, you know, student rebirth, campus rebirth.
It's that a remarkable story, important. Especially Mr. Galvin and Mr. Pritzker's dedication to this, that they're willing to write the bottom line to indeed implement the vision.
They were willing to bet, take the bet,
But it sounds like Mr. Galvin really needed some convincing.
Both of them did. Absolutely. I mean, this was a major disappointment for the institution that the two of them would not step up to the plate. And at that time, they were only asking for $25 million or something like that, or $15 million each, you know. The price went up pretty dramatically in 10 years, you know. But they were, you know, their fortunes had also gone up in that time.
Can you give us a sense in terms of Lou Collins? How much of this was his masterful interaction with these two gentlemen and working them in this process forward. Yes. How much of this did he see to begin with, or how much of it kind of evolved as
No,
as
I think
it
was all about him.
Okay.
All about him working
on
this.
Yeah, speak to that.
And I wasn't there, you know, I wasn't in the room or in the building.
Yeah.
Tom, let me get his name. I got to remember the name of our VP of Institutional Advancement that organized it.
Okay.
And I'll come along, you know, just
yeah.
And so Lou would spend a lot of time privately with each of them, talking to them, listening to them, going out to their homes, you know, dinners and all kinds of things. And I was like the front man organizing the formal conversations and creating the, or helping through all these staff groupings and conversations to organize the real ideas of the National Commission. And but then he was building around that to come up with this, the things that these two gentlemen could grab onto. Tom Garrow was the guy who was organizing the ask, as it were.
You think it was wise of IIT, apparently so, to have brought a lawyer on at that point within Lou Collins to have that sort of a strategic approach, or not necessarily so?
No, Lou suffered for being a lawyer. No, it was because Lou was real good at raising large amounts of money from very rich people. That was one of his crowning achievements, you know. And so the gifts not only from Galvin and Pritzker, but from the other big individuals like Al Self, the Duchossois family, and the McCormick Tribune Foundation, and, you know, many others, Delaney Trust. There's just so many of these huge gifts. People here don't understand how special it was that we were getting such large gifts from people that weren't alumni, for the most part. You know, it's not, most of the big money that comes into these great big universities comes from very rich alumni, and Galvin, only Pritzker was an alumnus at that time.
Yeah, that comes up with Mr. Galvin all the time. People ask us, what's the family connection? And it's his commitment to this university and what it does for Chicago and national industry.
The two of them, 50 years as members of our board, was quite amazing. So each one was like six, I think Bob was 17. Bob Galvin was maybe, I always call him 17 years, and Bob Pritzker was 16 years. But you said he came on board and he must have
become. In 1979 he took the chairmanship.
79, yeah, so it was 12 years in. 11 or 12 years,
All right, so the 1990s is this very crowded period of refounding the university and moving it forward. Speaking about your connection with Lou Collins and working very closely with him to move this all forward, was he committed to spending the rest of his career here at IIT? I assume so, regardless, up or down, in terms of success or not success.
Well, I think we measure it in his wanting to see through the reestablishment of the institution, the completion of the campaign, and then the implementation of the results from the campaign, and that effectively carried him to 2007 when he retired. So that was just, you know, it's just like, you know, in your case, when do you step down, you know? When do you run out of gas, or when do you run out of, you know, people's support, as it were? And so it was a good time. I think he started imagining stepping down in the early 2000s, but he needed to find a path to replace Bob Pritzker in his role, because Bob was becoming ill, you know, more and more debilitated with Parkinson's. So he needed to figure out who could he get as a new chair. And that's where he worked with Bob to attract John Rowe to the chairmanship, which was a brilliant thing by both of them.
One thing I think we as documentarians, Adam and I, are conscious of is that the successful stories, the things that happened, are documented, but the possibilities of what didn't happen or what might happen are the things that you can shed light on. What were the plans B or C if indeed the National Commission hadn't succeeded? What were the discussions about what could have happened?
Well, you know, we never talked about the horribles. We did create scenarios in the National Commission process, I guess, were kind of plan B or C, and tested the scenarios and tested them against reality. So one of the big scenarios was maybe we should get out of the undergraduate business and do graduate only, like a la Rockefeller University. And so we talked about that, or Caltech, which has a tiny undergraduate program and a bigger graduate program. And we looked at all those models and basically said, that's not really going to work. You know, the thing about a regular university, if it's not heavily endowed, you have to have that, the undergraduate experience, because those are the ones that really give you the money down the road. And you rely on those alumni. So that was kind of discarded. We also, at that time, were feeling real good about our graduate professional programs, and we were leading the way in the region in graduate professional degree programs. You know, these evening programs, the master's, the MS, dropping the S off the master's degree, so we didn't, you get a technical, you know, technical master's degree without a having to do a research paper. So it was very attractive to people in industry. And so I remember, that was one of the other main recommendations of the commission, was to build this professional master's program and use that money to recharge the undergraduate and rebuild the campus. But unfortunately, as things are, right when we made that recommendation in 95, the federal government, Congress, took away the tax deductibility of tuition for graduate students. Overnight, it killed our graduate, our domestic graduate degree program. We were running this land office business in the western suburbs. You know, we built the Rice campus, and all of the big corporations out there were sending their young people to get master's degrees out there, and it was doing great. So we said, well, there's our engine of growth. I remember the the engine of growth is our master's degree programs, and we'll. And then we can kind of slowly rebuild a quality undergraduate program. So, you know, in 1995, that program almost went away overnight. But in 96, with the advent of the improvement of the internet, remember the internet, our first website was 1994. You know, so by 96, all of a sudden, we started to get all these applications flying in from all over the world, which we never did anything to get them. And at that time, Dar Shwasan had been appointed the VP for International Affairs out of the National Commission recommendation for Bob Galvin, which I forgot to mention, that Bob Galvin's gift to us was this, you know, think about calling yourself International Institute of Technology. If you look at the National Commission report, you'll see that in the addendum. And Darsh was given the job of making that real. So, first, the market showed up easy with no expense to us. Then Darsh went to India and started the India program that, you know, in Bangalore, that then led to a real national, you know, huge influx of Indian graduate students, which really saved our bacon.
You know, it's interesting when you look at the history of organizations or even nations, how it's a mixture of intentionality and accident. IIT was saved by the Second World War. The same in many sorts of ways.
Right.
You know, where we were refounded in 1940, but you know, luckily within 18 months of that, the war came to really
push all
of
the
V12
programs.
Heard that
right.
before in terms of the availability of the internet and the people now coming for what we had or could have, and so that's
amazing. If you were to look at the change in, if you just looked at the names on the. Names of the graduates on the commencement, if you have the commencement books by year, if you were to look at the graduate students' names in 1995 and compare them to 1997, you would see such a dramatic change. I mean, we used to have, I mean, the Thais and the Indians would compete for the most complicated names to say. So we used to, you know, one of our faculty members would have to read the linguist would have to read the names because none of the deans could pronounce them, you know. Now we handle that at the college.
Greg Pulliam is so good at it.
Well, Greg is the guy,
Right, yeah.
Well, did that cause a lot of friction in terms of such a rapid culture change on the campus?
Good question. I don't think it really caused too much friction at first because we'd always had, first of all, we've all had international faculty. You know, so a good portion of our faculty even then were international, you know, so they were the ones to teaching. That was the rub with the students. So on one hand, I don't think there were like real friction. It mm-hmm. just worked. On the other hand, we were very sloppy. At that time, we didn't have, you know, we were still extremely weak financially. I mean, compared to now, now we look like we're weak, but there's nothing compared to then. And so we never really comprehensively thought about the student experience for all these new graduate mm-hmm. students. Mm-hmm. It's taken us 20 years to kind of almost get it right now. Uh-huh. And the poor students, I mean, they just had to fight their way through the nightmare of the place. You know, and also, you know, so much was paper. You're going around all these different offices. You know, one stop didn't exist. There's this, all this lack of customer service, and these students fought through the whole damn thing and got great degrees and went back and doing very well in their countries, you know. So we always felt that the Indian influx was, I always felt at least, was because of, we would joke about they could go back to their countries and say with a straight face that they graduated from IIT. It just happened to be IIT Chicago instead of IIT Mumbai. But they, you know, it just was an example of, we rode the wave of the economic boom in India in the 90s mm-hmm. and the education boom where the kids could not all be satisfied by the institutions in India. The tiniest percentage gets into those, mm-hmm. the IITs. And Darsh then, well, magically by, and actually, Bob Galvin set him up with Motorola to fund the development of the curriculum and the locating of the Bangalore program mm-hmm. there. And mm-hmm. that then allowed Darsh, the publicity associated with that, built on accelerating the Indian influx here mm-hmm. in the graduate degree programs. And because we had those master's degree programs that we had developed, remember I talked, talked about that, it fit perfectly with getting them a cost-efficient way of getting through in a master's degree in 2 years or less. Mm-hmm. So it was a very nice package for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You remember here, just to give you a feeling of what was happening in the institution, in terms of undergraduates, in undergrad, you know, in we had about 2,500 undergraduates in 2000, mm-hmm. and somewhere around that when I got here in 1993, and we were in the 80s, we were used to having 500 first-year students a year, mm-hmm. roughly. And then when it dropped to 237, and suddenly the classes were 200, 237, 300, 400, the number was, it was starting to go down, you know, so suddenly it was 1,800 undergraduates, something like that. And a lot of dropouts. They would drop out after the first year, so we had a terrible retention rate. And that just started to drag down our national reputation. And about that time, U.S. News and World Report showed up with this study. Mm-hmm. You know, no one would know what you're doing so badly if you didn't have U.S. News and World Report, mm-hmm. which came, you know, that started in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And the Princeton Review, also the Princeton Review was the other, oh my God, we'd shudder every time the Princeton Review would come out and the Tribune insisted on finding, you know, where the rankings where we had an Illinois institution mentioned in the best five or the worst five, you know, they'd always print it. So the day that in 1996 that Blair Kamen, see if I can remember that timing, that we announced the design competition. It was on the front page of the Tribune. Maybe it was the spring, summer of 97. Hmm. It was the summer of 97, yeah. They printed also the Princeton Review that labeled us as one of the five ugliest campuses in the United States. It was a great juxtaposition.
Nowhere to go but up, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we have gone up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now we're not in that list anymore. Yeah. In fact, we're not in any of the, although we did get the last one, we finally got into one of the bad lists having to do with faculty attention or something like that.
Mm. All right, anyway. Well, I know your really exciting and personally gratifying stories are after the year 2000, but we'll still stick a little bit before it. Such a formative period for the university and reformative period. Can you let us know a bit, in terms of the point of your initially coming in terms of, like, say, the Rice campus, how much of that was a notion that that would perhaps be the central campus at some point in the future, or was that not the intention or possible benefit of having the suburban campus? You've talked about the fact that at that point, 25 years ago, was a notion that, yeah, you should mm-hmm. head toward, still toward the suburbs.
Right.
Was that one of the Mr. Felberg's, Dr. Felberg's notions about what Rice Campus could do?
Don't know.
Okay.
Don't know him.
Yeah.
But I will tell you that the undercurrent in the board, among the board members at that time, was that we really needed to move out of here. It was never going to work. They were, frankly, afraid to come to campus for the board meetings.
All right.
We ran board meetings downtown. I think we alternated between downtown and here for our board meetings.
All right.
And I kind of didn't know people were afraid to come, but then I found out later.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always this undercurrent that maybe it was, you know, we talked about it. And we even, the university even authorized, I don't think many people knew about this, but they authorized a planner to look at alternative sites.
Yeah, see, that's the sort of thing also that's invaluable in terms of maybe it isn't documented, but
yeah,
you
we
can
don't
speak
want
to,
well,
it.
We don't want to talk about it because,
okay.
frankly, the word got out
mm-hmm.
that that's what we were doing, and Mayor Daley just went nuts.
Uh huh. Uh-huh.
And so we had this amazing thing, and Lou and I hope I might as well tell a story now. You know, people are retired, so
yeah.
In Christmas of '94, so think about the National Commission report draft is out.
Yeah.
We're looking at the campus. And right before Christmas in '94, the word got out that Mayor Daley was looking around for a new location for the police headquarters because he had to get the thing out of down. The building on 11th and State was just a complete disaster.
Hmm.
So the putative location of that was going to be adjacent to the new 911 headquarters on the west side.
All right.
Lou had a conversation at a cocktail party over Christmas
mm-hmm.
with Bob Wislow, and Bob Wislow of U.S. Equities was charged with looking at the sites for the police headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou knew Bob, and so he said to Bob, he said, you know, Bob, it's not about locating that thing next to our campus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a great thing that would be to help us stay here because
yeah.
we have to solve the safety problem.
Yeah.
And if you don't, you know, our board has taken a hard look at going somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And that got back to Mayor Daley.
Yeah.
And boy, I'm just trying to remember all these moments. Because that was also associated with me coming on board, and there's another story about moving the L-tracks.
Mm-hmm.
I have to
mm-hmm.
maybe I should yeah. tell you that one. I'll go back. I'll roll back to the L-tracks.
Yeah.
And I'll tell
yeah.
you this story.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Lou put the bug in Bob's ear about moving it here,
mm-hmm.
and I then got spun up working with Bruce Limatainen of Finkel, who funded one of our architecture alums to do a feasibility study of placing it on our campus, the police headquarters, as an idea for creating safety and stability here, and of course implementing one of those ideas that, well, we need help from the city to be able to stay here.
Yeah. But it's just like what you've already indicated to us in some of the documentation, IIT proposing itself as a chief actor in some of these things, for example, developing immediately south of 35th Street. This is something that the narrow reports don't oftentimes document, that we're part of, and you and your team and Lou Collins with the mayor are part of this much more strategic process.
That's right.
That is
there's a whole many things that went on. Yeah, I mean, there was a whole process there, I mean, literally of trying to influence them in their study to put it here.
Yeah.
And I actually, December 19th of 1995, I actually reached an agreement with the head of the General Services Administration to put the police headquarters on our campus, on
mm-hmm.
the parking lot south,
mm-hmm.
over there by the L tracks, by the L
mm-hmm.
station.
Yeah.
And in January, the first week in January of 1996, Mayor Daley said, no, we're not putting it there, put it across the street where it is now.
Yeah.
Because he took a look at the politics of the thing, because what we were going to demand, quote, unquote, demand is not the right word, but quid pro quo would have been tearing down the chemistry research building and building a multi-story parking structure and have the city pay for it so we could move the cars that are sitting on that lot over there.
Oh, I see. All right. Yeah. Sounds like this is a good time to formally bring in Mayor Daley. who's elected in, I think, the spring of 1989, and is obviously committed to the South Side, the near South Side, because this is his political dynasty's place. How early on were you and your team aware of his keen involvement? It sounds like, you know, we've heard some instances already, and how did that develop, and how important is Mayor Daley to keeping IIT here?
His role was incredibly important to the success of what we got done here in the 90s and the early 2000s, and in so many ways. And yet, it was a very rocky relationship between the Lou and him and me.
Please speak to that, if you can.
We can't speak too hard. We're not talking too much about
right.
it.
Okay.
Part of it was because, in general, the mayor had this love-hate relationship with Illinois Institute of Technology that I did not know anything about. Here I am given the government portfolio, you know, in the fall of when it started. I mean, I really remember my first instance was in the fall of 93 when I was hired. I went to a meeting I was hired in September 1. It's like 2 days before I was hired, a meeting with the CTA and the city that had been cooked up by Lou and his friends to try to get them to convince them to move the Green Line out of the middle of campus. Did you hear that? Have you known about this?
Yes.
And so we went down there to talk to them. And, well, I told you the story in there, I guess. So he said, you know, you can move it. The deal was already cooked, you know. And so they had the symbol of our lack of access and lack of appreciation by the city was that they never talked to Illinois Tech about the fact that they had orchestrated the shutdown of the Green Line for 2 years to rebuild it. And we learned about it in the paper.
You can speak in generality. Should have been going back a little bit further. I know that the first Mayor Daley, his father, was very supportive of John Retaliata and the administration through to the early 70s.
Right.
What goes wrong between 73
and
89?
The story is that we had nobody here that paid any attention to the city and worked the city, worked City Hall. Nobody did it. You know, the first guy to come in here, Mark Angelini, was hired like in 91 to start looking at how we had a government affairs portfolio. Before him, there was nobody. And you heard the apocryphal story of Mayor Daley when he was getting his law degree, coming down on the L from DePaul and getting off and walking over to our library to study, to do his law work before he walked home to the family home down in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
And so the story goes that he observed, even then, that we weren't taking care of our campus. That was in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
You know, after Retaliata left.
Yeah.
And, you know, that just grew. And so we would hear these stories from him driving through campus, you know, and he just hated some of the aesthetic choices that we made, like having chain link fences surrounding our parking lots instead of wrought iron, which they're all wrought iron now because of him. Or we painted the chain link black over here. So it really was a difficult thing, but yet we needed to pay attention. And by the way, I'm thinking I'm a year off. Maybe it is 93 that first story started. So anyway, they wouldn't let us do that because the deal was already done. And it turned out the reason they couldn't move the L is because the money that they had put aside for the renovation of the Green Line could only be used for repairs. It couldn't be used for new construction. And then furthermore, to have new construction, we're going to put it on the Metro tracks. It would have been a 2-year environmental study, which they couldn't delay because they'd already got all the local community groups to agree.
All right.
But just imagine that they didn't even talk to us. We read about it in the paper.
I guess in defense of IIT, between the death of the first Mayor Daley and the election of the second Mayor Daley, City Hall was in chaos.
And the Harold Washington regime was here. But, you know, Bill Grimshaw was here on the faculty. Bill could have taken care of that. His wife, Jackie, helped run their Washington's operation.
But why didn't that happen in terms of like,
well,
the
because leadership at Illinois technology was in chaos in that time,
right,
too.
Okay, all right. Okay,
it was the end of Tom's, you know, Tom Martin was 2 years away from quitting when Harold Washington was elected, and Tom was spending more time worried about his wife, who was very ill, and fighting the faculty, and he wasn't thinking about, you know, growth in here. And then you had the Feldberg regime, and he was a South African, so how far was he going to get with Mayor Washington, huh?
That's the ultimate
insult to the African-American community, hiring a South African to run
during
your school.
During the period of the sanctions, which were still in place.
Yeah, that's true. Who drove around the Jaguar, you know that story. Yeah, we have.
Definitely heard that.
So I think that really, it was coincident with that Mayor Daley would come in with his tremendous interest in rebuilding neighborhoods, that the university would go through this exercise in thinking about its future and its location and what needed to happen here. And then so the story of my experience is that in spite of everything, it was still my job to build a relationship with the mayor that would lead to the improvements that we needed and the cooperation we needed from the city to make the big improvements. And the way we did that was through our trustees who acted as intermediaries for Lou and myself. They were the ones who saved us, you know. The mayor loved Chuck Finkel, Charles Finkel, and Bruce. The mayor was deeply involved with building the Finkel camp, the Finkel Steel campus up there on North, near North and Clybourne or Cortlandt Street. Jaskul Kuterman, who was hired by the Finkels to be the liaison to City Hall to orchestrate all that stuff, was given to us by Chuck and Bruce. They paid for them to be our consultants to work with the city for five, seven, 8 years. And we never paid, the university never paid a nickel for that. And they then acted as, they helped staff and orchestrate all of our major events that we did with the things that we did with the mayor to help him build, you know, make the commitments that he did to fix the campus.
As time went on, as you turned the corner and things moved forward, you passed 94, 95, 96, how much progressively easier would it be for you to get on the phone or for Lou to get on the phone to the mayor, and now we're cruising, or was it always, he was quite detail-oriented and always keeping you on edge?
Okay. Never, if we'd had Jeannie Ahrens working for us at the time, Jeannie would have taken care of it just like she does with Mayor Emanuel, but we didn't have Jeannie Ahrens working for us at the time.
All right.
Jeannie was working for Jaskul Kuterman at the time,
All right.
coincidentally. And she became dear friends with Mayor Daley. But she, you know, I learned so much from her and how to work with mayors, but I didn't have that as a resource. My whole background was state government, so, and I was mainly focused. So I really, in that time, on one hand, I was juggling getting the commitments from the mayor for the transformation of State Street and 33rd Street, and also getting the CTA to agree to let us build a tube. But really what I was building up to was making major requests from the state for the transformation of campus.
Your state connections, were they, did Mayor Daley have any trouble with the fact that maybe you had more of a state focus? Is this a rivalry between the Democratic and Republican parties or not?
No, he didn't know enough about that.
Okay.
It really. And he didn't know me well enough to know that I was doing that too.
All right. Okay.
So
that wasn't a factor.
No, the factor was the fact that he didn't really respect, you know, it was just a kind of a love-hate relationship with him, you know? And so we just never were far enough out in front in understanding how to work with him successfully to do it. And other than, well, until we realized that the answer was work through the trustees. And he's very comfortable with our trustees.
Was there enough natural attrition with the Board of Trustees so that it was able to move forward in terms of a better crew to work with the mayor, or?
No, they were all in place. Mm-hmm. They were all in place effectively.
All right. So they were perhaps underutilized, or?
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. right. They offered to help. You know, I remember the incredible meeting with Bruce Lee Metynan and Chuck Finkel, mm-hmm. when they said, you know, David, you guys need to clean up your act with the mayor, and we're going to help you do it.
All right.
And we want you to be the anchor. We want Illinois Tech to be the anchor, or IIT, whatever they call it now. Mm-hmm. And we're going to help you do it. And I said, fine. Thank you very much.
All right. Right.
And that was a huge thing for us, mm-hmm. you know, to have that understanding and that support and the mm-hmm. closeness of those relationships. But Craig Duchessois was a key player. Jim Kiley, who was on the board in the late 90s, I think. Very important. To Tom Langtoe was very important. Mm-hmm. Those guys all know the mayor. Tom was his, you know, he was his campaign chairman, his first campaign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Very political.
And he and Governor Ryan worked well together, right?
Yeah.
And so when Governor Ryan took an interest in campus, then that was not competitive, it was,
no.
It was cooperative. And
no, as a matter of fact, the Governor Ryan's, the way we got them, commitment from the CTA for the tube, to do the tube, in the end was because Governor Ryan put the money in. We never mm-hmm. could have got to first base with the CTA if we hadn't had the $9 million commitment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What about IPRO? You want to talk a little bit about how we got IPRO done?
Oh, I mean, yeah, sure. Yeah.
That's just an amazing thing. So IPRO came through the National Commission, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Hassan mm-hmm. Naguib, who was on the National Commission at that time, is, you know, faculty in aerospace engineering, brought the idea to the consideration of the National Commission. He was either on the commission or he was leading on the faculty council or faculty advisory committee or whatever we call them.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought that idea from Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you know that, I don't know. But Boeing mm-hmm. had a Skunk Works operation that they used where they would assemble interdisciplinary teams to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put them together and they say, you guys go work on this problem. You learn how to work together, mm-hmm. different professions, whatever, mm-hmm. and then they would solve a technical problem somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So Hassan made the, you know, brought this great idea to us and said, you know, nobody else is doing this, and what a way to build across the professional undergraduate programs that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Get the engineers and the computer science kids and the architects all working together,
mm-hmm.
which was a revolutionary idea because up until then, most engineering schools had interdisciplinary, maybe some interdisciplinary, but mainly their project-oriented learning was all single discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So the commission accepted it as an idea, and we started with Hassan ran the first IPRO. Test IPRO in the fall of 95, so we jumped right into it, got a bunch of kids involved mm-hmm. to do it, and that, you know, gave the report to the board and everything, said, this is great, let's keep doing it, you know, and all of a sudden started to build that program, and then Tom Jacobius was brought in even early on to kind of staff the thing,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and we started to build it, but then as soon as that happened in 96, we had to, the university had leadership, the president, had to go to the faculty and say, and all the departments and say, we want to make this real, and to make it real, we're going to need 6 credit hours out of your degree programs, and moved over to general education.
Oh.
Hmm.
And that began a 10-year fight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we got it accepted, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. but it wasn't really accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, probably other people can tell the story better. I've told Tom and he had this. But
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but I then, just in terms of my thing, I got then organized to staff John Callan, first John Callan and then Phil Troik, to work as the faculty advisors to the development of IPRO and establish mm-hmm. the pedagogy of IPRO
mm-hmm.
and work with other faculty members and go around to all the departments and explain what it was. And that was mm-hmm. really quite an amazing thing for me as a staffer
mm-hmm.
to get in the middle of that. Because, you know, the faculty controls curriculum. And this mm-hmm. was a violation of that fundamental rule.
Yeah.
So we had the faculty members basically fronting.
Mm-hmm.
And Hassan was involved in it, too. And Hassan had become he became the vice president of academic affairs for the, home. Well, he was like the provost of the main campus. We had Lou had split up. He didn't have a provost, so he created this new vice president of academic affairs position for the downtown campus and this campus. So we split for quite a while. And Tossin had this campus. So he was like overseeing the IPRO implementation, but the staffing going on was with me and Phil Troik and John Callant. It wasn't pretty.
How long do you feel like it took people to come around to the idea of the IPRO?
They never came around.
No?
The real faculty?
Yeah.
Even now.
Well, what we did was we realized that that was never quite going to work completely, so they modified the concept. Here's some couple of reasons, okay? No money. The IPRO program, unlike CAMRS and some of the other programs in the nation, never had a big endowment to run it. I mean, the Leadership Academy has a big endowment to run it. You know, that's why it's successful. IPRO has never had an endowment. It's got money in fits and starts, and, you know, people pay to have their corporate IPROs run. But it never did. It was just, we took it out of our hide. We took it out of the faculty's hide. And faculty, for the most part, are not equipped to be successful project managers. And they were most of them were very uncomfortable in that role. So what has happened, two things happened in 2007 when John Anderson took place, and I mean, particularly 2008 when Alan Cram became provost. We set up the concept of IPRO professors. So we hired, we spent the money, the university spent the money and hired people that knew how to run IPRO, knew how to run projects, okay? Project, and at the same time, the provost said, stop fighting, you're not gonna win this one. You know, because they kept trying to come in the faculty council and reduce IPRO from 2 to 1, you know? And now it's still two courses effectively, but it's also modified. So that those two things happen, and now it's firmly embedded in the budgets of the departments and the and it has its own IPRO program with a good staff. So now it's much more effective than it was.
Okay, all right.
And we have IPRO 2.0, and then we got the Idea Shop in 2010. You know, that really solidified it.
All right.
And now we're building the whole Kaplan Institute that's effectively the home of IPRO.
So Alan Cram was able to, with John Anderson, move that forward in terms of addressing, very frankly, speaking with the faculty about the fact that this is here to stay and bringing
in. Yeah, he had to do it finally because Lou also was struggling with, he really struggled to find a real provost for a lot, I don't know what the whole background is, but his life would have been a lot easier if he had a real provost. And he hired a few of them, and they didn't work out for lots of reasons.
Imagine it's unusual to find a provost who is going to be expert in identifying people who can wear those two hats. Or both.
But the place smoothed out a lot, you know, when John came in and decided to hire a traditional provost that he could trust. And then it just was hard. Because it was mainly Lou, me, and Marianne Smith to kind of trying to figure out how to work with the faculty, and that was Marianne did a great job. Everybody appreciated her and her loyalty, you know, her loyalty and her honesty and transparency. But still, it was very hard.
Well, we're about in the third of the interview by now, and I've been asking questions about the 90s, but you had indicated, you know, your autonomy and expertise and credentials here made the period after about 2000 your golden era. So open up
Let me talk about a few other things that happened in the 90s that are important, maybe related to. But you know what I'd like to do is just have a quick break and get some water, okay?
Sure.
I should have had a glass of water before we started this.
We'll put you back on.
Okay.
This is off the record.
No, it's not off the record.
Okay, all right.
The thing that you talk about, well, should we go on 2000? The amazing thing that I had in the 90s, from 95, when the National Commission recommendations were announced, until about 98, was that I was in charge of, it felt like I was in charge of everything.
Okay.
I used to call myself the vice president for everything else.
Of course.
My office was the one closest to the president. So if he ever needed any, he just came next door to say, David, do this, you know, kind of a thing. So, so I was in charge of overseeing the implementation of the recommendations of the National Commission. And at that time, there was no obvious ability to get money out of either the state or the federal government for a lot of reasons. The Republicans were in control in Washington and in Springfield for a little bit of that time, and there was no money. It was the last end of the Edgar administration, so there wasn't a lot of easy targets there, even though I did start to test the water in Washington for money for the tube. But anyway, so what I was doing there was a couple of roles. One was organizing each of the planning initiatives that had to be done to focus on the rebirth, renewal of the campus. So, and the other thing that happens, the chief facilities officer, the chief administrative guy, CFO, Joel Asruth, quit about 95, 96 and moved over to the Museum of Science Industry, and Lou did not have a new guy here in place for a couple of years. He was acting his own CFO, you know. So for all of the facilities side of the business, I was kind of running things. It's kind of cool, you know. I didn't know anything about this stuff. What do I know as a lobbyist, you know? So that included, I staffed the development of the Lohan. Remember, we talked about 95, we had the these preliminary activities, but then the Lohan Master Plan, I was basically the liaison to them for the university. I staffed the, as soon as the Lohan Master Plan came in, we then did a feasibility study for all of the recommendations for housing, academic buildings, all that stuff. And we engaged Mesereau Stein, well, it was Stein and Company at the time. And I then managed the guy who basically took each of the projects recommended, priced them, and developed a funding, how could we develop a private sector funding strategy? So we looked, for instance, at renewing the apartment buildings, the Mies apartment buildings, by trying to get a private sector partner. We actually went through an RFP process, which, by the way, 20 years later, we're still trying to do it, and we haven't figured out a solution yet. But so we did something like that. We also, Lohan recommended that we engage a private sector partner to build faculty housing adjacent to campus. And we went through the whole exercise of acquiring the block on Michigan Avenue, where Michigan Place is right now. And I ran that whole exercise up to the point that John Collins came to then work with me. But I went through the whole whole process of identifying potential developers, and and we got the developers, and then the universe, then the architects threw a fit because it wasn't pretty enough. So they made us go back through a rebid process, redesign, and let them, and they got themselves involved. You know, it wasn't on the, it's kind of on the property. But before that, we had to go through this little dance of acquiring that property. And so what happened there is that Vandercook College of Music was in this old building along with ROTC, and conveniently the AAR moved out to Pueblo, Colorado. So we started a lease agreement with Vandercook and moved them over here. We took that building, which was adjacent to ICO, we sold that building to Illinois College of Optometry. We also moved ROTC from there onto the campus because it was over in that building too. And ICO had this parking lot where the old mansions, where the student the fraternities were north of 32nd Street, and they were using it as a parking lot. And then we, in the swap, we got the property, which we then were able to leverage into the Michigan Place development.
All right. Real quick, maybe interruption to the chronology. We didn't ask you early on how much you would want to say about your life, so that people know. Before you came to IIT in 1990, was it, or 1989, you talk about being a lobbyist. What well suited you for your career here? What was kind of more extraneous? Do you want to spend a couple minutes talking about your personal life before you got here?
So there's a couple of threads that that made me an ideal job for me, and many of which Lou Collins did not know about when he hired me. But one of them was in a 19. First of all, I've always been all my career in the private not-for-profit sector. And I had, in that role, I had run boards. So in the 70s, I anointed myself as a futurist. And I became part of the World Futures Movement around the bicentennial.
All right.
And that gave me this ability to think and learn and know all the techniques for doing visioning exercises. In the 80s, I was the executive vice president of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, a decade of the 80s. Oh. And that's when I cut my teeth on Springfield and got to know everybody. I knew everybody in Springfield, you know. I knew all the governors, I knew all the legislators, and that was part of my job. Yeah. But I also ran the strategic plan for the chamber, its own strategic plan. I took that then, my learning from that, and I translated it into managing or acting as a consultant to local chambers of commerce all over the state to help them build strategic plans to envisage their future. I also managed and staffed the board of trustees for the chamber. Then in 89 I left the chamber and became the president of the Illinois Coalition from 89 to 93. That's where Lou found me, and there I basically learned all about higher education research and development. I had the presidents of all of major universities in town on my board, along with legislative leaders and government, and the top business leaders in the city were all on my board. I was me and a secretary in this incredible board. And so that then distilled in me the understanding of the needs of higher education research. So future visioning, strategic planning, and understanding universities, in fact, the thing they liked about me is I gave Illinois Tech a whole lot of money. I gave ITRE money to redo the metals and materials building into their that research center for the fountain, you know, the foundry for research, you know, for gear manufacturing. I funded the the state with state money. I managed it along with another guy from the U of I. We also jump started all of the collaborative access teams that exist to this day down at Argonne.
All right.
So they really liked me because I gave them a lot of money. You know.
So you're impacting campus many years
before then. So Lou liked the way I ran. All he knew was he was on the board, so he showed up at board meetings and he saw me. He said, "Well, this is cool," and he needed somebody to run the commission. That's how I was hired. But he didn't really know about all the futures. He knew I could run a board and I could operate with a high level group, which is what he wanted me to do with the commission.
Any other formative experiences that quizzed you about in terms of your position coming here? And you know, you talk about being a futurist, and
I'm a futurist and a historian. So that's a fun thing. You know, I've ended up being kind of the visible university historian and tour giver, and and my appreciation of art and architecture also helped me respect the campus, and lead to the fact that I basically am the guy that got, you know, Crown Hall put on the national, you know, a National Historic Landmark, and the campus put on the National Register.
I shouldn't forget to ask. Obviously, the University Archives owes much of its reason for being to you. Obviously, the centennial in 1990 and your strong historical consciousness apparently may be one of the first at that level to have that consistently and to move forward to hiring Catherine Brooke in 1998 and whatnot. So
We were one of the early advocates for it. Thank God we did it.
How useful has expanding the knowledge of the history of this campus been for you, or for you using it as a tool with other people, other operations on campus? For example, trying to infuse a historical consciousness and build on the past and remind people of the legacy and how...
We do that in every new... I mean, the most obvious and visible way is in the new employee orientation, which new staff members appreciate, because it truly is... talking about the historic campus and the history lesson truly gives people a pride, a basic, you know, for startup employees, a pride and an understanding of the university that they wouldn't otherwise have.
You weren't a history major in college, were you?
I was a history major in college, absolutely.
Kind of was feeling that.
Yeah, there. No, AB History, Stanford, 1964.
All right.
And I've always had a love and affection of history.
Yeah.
And appreciation for different cultures and all the rest of that stuff has helped.
Right.
You know.
And I know as community affairs moves forward here and becomes more defined, you have an important leadership role in that as well, which is getting beyond the nuts and bolts of campus and understanding community groups and where they come from.
Right. So I had that role. I mean, I tag team with Leroy throughout the 90s. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I finished all of the little projects I was working on. Just interrupted me, but can I go through all? So we had the planning exercise that led to the development of Michigan Place, which has been a very successful development. Even though we our goal was to have 10% of 10% of the units occupied by faculty and staff. Mm-hmm. For a while we achieved it, but I don't think we have it now. The big thing we missed, of course, is not about housing; it's about schools. Mm-hmm. That's why you don't have faculty living around here. And staff. The next thing we did was the landscaping master plan. So once we had the main master plan, then the feasibility studies, and I was starting working around how do we fulfill that. And so then we also started the landscaping master plan that was funded through the campaign by Irv Futlick, that created Futlick Lane, But that led to, that was 97, 98, and the city, the mayor, that was the big payoff of all this work with the Mayor Daley. The first big payoff was his saying, okay, or second big payoff, two things we asked him to do. Mm-hmm. One was to, three things. One was indeed move the police headquarters here, which they did. The second was give us the okay or tell the CTA to play nice with us on the tube. Mm-hmm. And the third was then to make the commitment to fund the transformation of State Street and 33rd Street with a $7 million city commitment, and use our landscape architects for the design. That was big, huge. You look down there today and you see the complete transformational character of the thing, particularly because all the ash trees are dying now, and we have all the new trees that are growing up in their place, so they'll quote, barely be missed, although something I'll have to talk to Bruce Watt. Bruce Watt is going to have a strategy for replacing those ash trees. So those were like the big precursor. In addition, I was given a job of running a strategic plan at the university. I ran, I created, managed, and staffed every strategic plan from 1996, which all the way through 2009. In the early years, what we were doing was establishing goals and objectives and metrics for driving the implementation of the National Commission Plan.
All right. Keep it rolling, because as you push forward, I mean, there's, like you were discussing.
So then there was then as we started to imagine building on the campus, about that time in the middle, late 90s, 96, 97, we got on the radar screen, particularly after the gift. I think that was, the big gift made all the news. Mm-hmm. We got on the radar screen of the minority contracting group saying, well, what are you guys doing to support minority hiring? Mm-hmm. And that led to a big, never a battle, but a very active dialogue with a number of predominantly African-American contracting groups about what commitment were we going to make to helping to rebuild the South Side. And Leroy and I managed that together, and there were some relatively contentious meetings. We were kind of refereeing and holding it together, and we were having, Jesse Jackson was coming in here, and Congressman Rush and everybody else to say, come on, you guys, you got to do something. Out of that came a very substantial and real MWBE program for contracting that we continue to this day. And we have the statistics to show that we really played ball that way.
So those relationships were successful.
Didn't look good at the beginning, but that's what happened. And so the building of the State Free Village and the Campus Center and a lot of other stuff, we hewed to those rules,
Was Alderman Tillman, was this part of her District 3rd?
Yes, absolutely.
For some time? And,
So her big, my big work with her was on the tech park.
Okay.
And because we needed TIF funding for the tech park. The other stuff was basically done with other people, with state private money. But the tech park, I needed TIF funding from the city.
All right.
So,
and is it indeed true that aldermen are, by tradition, given a fair amount of control over such initiatives?
Absolutely, complete control.
Okay, all right.
I mean, in the permitting process too. So you always have to have them in your court.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I consider one of my great success stories in actually being able to successfully work with Alderman Tillman to get these things done.
Those of us who followed Chicago history for the last 20, 30 years, she's for a long time the most, one of the most colorful people on the city council, very flamboyant.
Yeah.
The big hats and
and
whatnot, but was she actually was that more of a public persona, and she actually was fairly, you know, straightforward to deal with?
No,
no, you found it to be
Well, we found the way to her heart, which was the supporting the development of the Harold Washington Cultural Center.
All right,
and so what I did was raise a whole bunch of money from outside to support development of a computer research center, a computer center for students. In the Harold Washington Center.
At 47th and King.
Yeah. And we staffed it and developed it. And Leroy and I then tag team, you know, get that all done. And so that was, she liked that.
I do remember.
She could understand that, yeah.
Okay.
So I, you know, I went, knew her real well. And, you know, just like we know Alderman Dowell. And Alderman Dowell is a little more straightforward, or a lot more straightforward.
Yeah. And she's a marvelous Alderman.
Yeah.
Are they direct? Is she the direct successor of?
And arch enemy.
Oh, really?
Well, obviously, you know, Dorothy is not happy when she lost.
Well, in terms of the Driehaus competition and the buildings here on State Street, I think we're moving into that time frame in terms of turn of the millennium.
I completely forgot about that. You know, I was looking at all the things I did before 2000, and that's another one, another unlikely role for me. As a government affairs vice president and lobbyist to get involved in running that, managing that competition. But once again, I was, you know, kind of the only one there. That started in 96. The run-up to that started in 96. And because the target was to get Driehaus to fund the competition. And so Donna Robertson had just arrived on campus as a dean of architecture, and she and I tag-teamed in orchestrating that whole thing. And that had a couple of really important components to it. I mean, number one, we did turn to Jack Hartray and Jim Nagel of the College of Architecture to be the official staff, because we needed to have somebody that was credible with the architecture people that we were going to attract to the jury. And they helped us identify the jury members and all the rest of that stuff. But we actually ran, we organized the whole thing.
Right, and I know from the documentation and photographic representations, you were involved in every step step of that. You mentioned before that the prickly and evolving relationships with faculty. I'd imagine, like you say, moving forward with this group of people from the outside is a whole learning curve as well.
God knows, yeah. And, I remember, well, John Vinci was on the faculty at the time, you know, teaching faculty at the College of Architecture. He was the most vocal opponent of the Kohlhaas plan because it overarched the commons. He felt the commons was a beautiful, pristine, mist building that did not need the schlocky work of Kohlhaas overlapping it. You know, and so he then fought us through the, even though he was a faculty member, he fought us through the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency and made Kohlhaas change the plans. So we negotiated a final agreement over that, so that it, in effect, touches the commons but does not corrupt the commons.
So you had, I assume, a prominent vote in selection of intern, or was it entirely off? You had no participation in
no participation.
In the vote. Okay, right. Just in terms of the management
really
of the project.
No. All right. Yeah, just managing the project. Okay. No, we picked the jury. The jury was not going to listen to someone like me. What did I know?
Right. Right.
And so it was pretty crazy. We had four, we got, of the finalists that we picked, we had four deconstructivists and one modernist. Well, Helmut Jahn, I guess, was kind of in between. I should call him a modernist, too. But I mean, if you think about that, in the Miesian tradition, the pure Miesian tradition, only Sejima from Japan was really in that. And she had a beautiful, delicate building, a glass building that never would have withstood the test of time.
Okay.
And, Zaha Hadid did a had a credible building, but it didn't solve the noise problem.
Right.
And what's his name? I forget his guy's. Eisenberg, Eisenman. he wanted to build the whole thing underground so we'd all be a bunch of moles. Because okay. He wasn't going to disturb the Mesian plain. He'd have the whole building would be underground with like light coming down in through these things, and that didn't work either.
How frustrating was it to be so intimately up to speed about all these proposals and all these operative principles, but not be on the jury?
Oh, it wasn't for me. I mean, well, because we knew that we were going to run a true international design competition. Mm-hmm. And, well, I should mention that for me, my whole role in this thing was getting Blair Kamen to follow the thing and write about it. Because I remember I was running marketing communications at that time. And so we saw, and even Dirk Lohan saw, the opportunity in running the design comp. He's the one that recommended we do one, is that you can get a lot of visibility. And frankly, there have been very few real design competitions in Chicago in a long time, with the exception of the Harold Washington Center Library, which people were kind of upset about in a way that it came out. And also, I'm sorry, the a version of it for the MCA. So at that time, even Kamen was arguing for a need for Chicago institutions and businesses to get back in the game and pay some money and get some real architects in the town. You know, and so that was where we started with, and we worked with Blair carefully. I built a strong friendship and relationship with him over that period, and we basically gave him exclusive access to the process.
In terms of your management with media relations, the various points, I'm sure that's a two-sided coin or a double-edged sword, where sometimes, you know, you benefit from the added profile, but then you have people in the media or critics or architectural people who will say, oh, why are you doing this or why are you doing
that? Kamen, for instance, Kamen was a great supporter of the process and hated the building. I mean, he wrote a nasty review about it because there was a lot, and he was right about a lot of the elements there, that because of value engineering, we ended up stripping away some of the things that he wanted to do that would have been last longer. I mean, the building is suffering from that. But
that's just the nature of the whole process.
Well, that reminds me, by the way, of my first introduction to running marketing communications for the university was after I'd been appointed the vice president in May of 95, and we'd had all of these dislocations, and we shut down a bunch of academic programs. You know, we discontinued 22 academic programs in one day and fired, you know, got rid of 30 faculty and 20 staff or something like that. That was the price that Lou Collins had to pay to gain the support of the board for going forward. And so we got a call. I got a call from Cranes that said, we understand Illinois Technology is going out of business. What's your comment? So I said, well, we'll get back to you. And 3 weeks later, we reorchestrated that story to be one about, yes, we are in financial difficulty, but we're not going out of business. And furthermore, we have all these great plans from the National Commission that are going to relaunch the institution. That's how we play. That's how we were able to turn it around.
All right, but that's immediately before the pledge, or is it after the pledge?
Well, it's well before the pledge.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
That's the spring of '95.
Okay. The pledge is done in '96.
The pledge was announced until November of '96.
Okay. All right. So
So anyway, I think that's a good way of saying what I was doing in this role was I didn't have any money to work with at the time. We were building we had the impetus of the campaign. We didn't really have the government engaged yet, but we had the impetus of the campaign that gave us credibility in the marketplace that set the stage for actually doing this stuff. And then, you know, to get the landscape master plan done, the university master plan, we started to work on the concept of how we would rebuild the Mies campus, and we started the work on Michigan Place. And out of that, you know, we started to slowly build these other ideas and leading to design competition. So, you know, the getting ready was the 95-96 period, 95-96-97. Then the implementation, then the planning and the design process was 97-98. And then 99 on was doing it.
All right. Okay.
And how much do you think the, not just the new construction, but having new buildings built with big name architects, what effect do you think that had on the perception of the campus locally and then maybe nationally, internationally.
Incredible. Well, the first thing it did is it doubled the size of the College of Architecture in 2 years. College of Architecture always coveted getting into other buildings, but we said, you know, you have to earn your way out of Crown Hall effectively by having a big enough staff. And lo and behold, now you see them in 3410, you know, and you see them over, and they got Metals and Materials, which they always wanted. You know, like George Shipwright was pounding on me all the time to influence Lou to give him that building. But we said, you know, if you can pay for it with tuition, we'll give it to you, you know. So internationally, I mean, it certainly helped that international coverage in terms of our recruiting. International recruiting became a lot easier. And the community, but it's taken a long time for the community to understand how much has changed. And I always point to the World Series, and the summer before the World Series in 2005 is when the rest of Chicago found out that this place had changed pretty dramatically because they were parking on our campus all summer because they were sold out. You know, you think about it, and then they were walking, and by the way, the public housing had now shut down south of campus, and they were taking down the building. So so the perception of safe, and the police headquarters had been up for 5 years. So, you know, those three things played into people reacquainting themselves with our campus, our main campus, people that had such a negative perception. I mean, more and more people would tell me, anecdotally at least, I go to meetings downtown, and people say, David, what happened to your campus? It's so beautiful. I said, oh, God, makes you feel good. You know, but that's really, but it took something like that, because otherwise people don't go south of Madison, you know? We've lived with the same, painted with the same tar brush that the White Sox have been painted about. No community, no neighborhood, you know, no bars, no nothing, you know, down here.
So now turn around for both of you.
That is never talked about anymore on Sports Talk Radio.
About
they never talk about that, the bad neighborhood, as the reason why nobody goes to Sox games.
All right.
They talk about the fact that the Sox aren't any good, which is unfortunate as a Sox fan. But anyway, that was a big turning point. And we still got 20 minutes. So so we think about now. Let's move towards what were the critical moments with state government that were so important.
Yeah.
And federal government that were so important to our success, or my success on behalf of the university in attracting big dollars that were transformational.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first thing was the tube. The tube. So what happened in the design competition when we picked Cole House? The next thing we did, and this was like in January they were picked right. I think it was right after Christmas of 1997, and then before we announced the winners, we priced the project, power construction, priced the project of building it, because we, at that time, we had $25 million to build the thing, was the commitment from, you know, we had $10 million, we knew we had $10 million from McCormick, and we had $10 million from the match, and then we had $5 million from another donor. So we only had $25 million to build the building, so we needed to know how much it was cost. So they kind of made it look like it would be $25 million. But the tube was priced at $2 million. And the when we announced the thing, the next thing we did was to go downtown and check with the city on building it. Fire marshal going running the traps on what it was going to take with the building office, and we went to the CTA to ask them if we could build this tube around their tracks. You know, they said, "What? You got to be out of your mind!" You know, the only and so the two critical things were the CTA just said, "This is crazy." You know, I mean, luckily Frank Cruzzi was in charge of CTA at the time, and he was had a great affection for modern architecture, so he was willing to have his staff work on it with us. But the fire marshal took one look at the thing and said, sorry, I can't just have a quarter inch stainless steel between the building and the L-tracks. I got to have an 8-hour fire separation. An 8-hour fire separation turns into 8 inches of reinforced concrete. So the tube price suddenly shot up from $2 million to effectively $13 million by one day.
Yeah, yeah.
The other critical decision was, meanwhile, so we're trying to work out an easement with a legal agreement with the CTA. The other thing that they found in the spring of 97 was that the CTA engineer said, well, what happens if the train gets trapped in the tube and catches on fire? How are you going to get people out of there? And so everybody's going, we know escape chutes, all kinds of crazy stuff, you know. And finally, Dirk Lohan said, well, why don't you just open up the tube on top? You don't need that for acoustical protection anyway. And so then the engineer said, yeah, you're right. So that's why it's open.
Oh, I see. All right.
But then I was given the job in 97 or 98. I can't remember the years right. Spring of 98, I guess. Carrying the tube idea to Washington and talking to Congressman Lipinski, Bill Lipinski at the time, and saying, can you figure out how to get this into the transportation bill? You know, it hasn't passed yet. And we need $9 million. And he said, well, we'll see what we can do. Because, of course, I needed to talk to Rush, not Lipinski. I mean, Rush said, go see Lipinski. And Lipinski, who was, you know, the Democratic leader of the Transportation Committee, said, well, sorry, the negotiations, effectively, the negotiations are all done. You're out of luck. You're too late. And then Governor Ryan was elected in the fall of 98. And in this January of 99, he decided he wanted to do a big capital bill. He knew we needed was the city, state was starving for capital money. And so I saw that, and at that time, it was very cool. The dean of dean or one of the law schools said, you know, I got this guy on my advisory council named Jerry Marsh, and he's very close to Governor Ryan. Why don't you go talk to him? And so we talked to Jerry, and we hired him as our lobbyist in Springfield, and he and Sam Vincent were the two guys that helped us work with Governor Ryan to get him interested in this, and we sold it to him as this building will be a true sign of the rebirth of Southside and the reemergence of Southside institutions. And he bought it. And then we agonized all during the spring of 99 whether or not this was going to get into the final bill, the tube money. But Jerry wrote the legislation and figured out the funding pack, the funding strategy for how to fund the bill.
All right.
He was definitely picked the right guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so
and so
a moment
in June of 99, it happened.
Yeah,
we got that thing in the bill.
If I remember, that's the sort of high watermark of Governor Ryan's effective power.
He's
only one term governor, and scandal started to slow him down.
Exactly right. And so in December of 1999, December 7th, I think I was trying to remember the date, we held the groundbreaking for the campus center. He came on campus. We did it on the north end of the parking lot where the charging station is. And it was so great. He's up there on the podium talking, and all of a sudden the L goes by.
He says,
see, you know, in 3 years, you won't hear that anymore.
So
great.
And Mayor Daley was there, and like you say,
he wasn't there.
He wasn't? Okay.
No, Mayor Daley doesn't go to, so this is the other thing we learned. Mayor Daley doesn't go to groundbreakings. He goes only to dedication. So he came to the dedication September 30th of 2003.
All right.
And, of course, Governor Ryan was in jail by then, so we didn't have a governor then.
See, this is the sort of thing us laymen just wouldn't know.
We found that out. I also found out, because we did this big song and dance about bringing him here to show him the plan when it was announced, because we had a big joint announcement. But we never cleared the design with him in advance, and he was very mad at us. It was one of those examples of not knowing how to work with him. But we couldn't have done it because it was a true competition. We couldn't have him say, I don't like the design, fix it.
Right.
So we were really stuck, but it's one of those things where if I'd had someone like Jeannie Aarons here, they probably would have said to me, you know, you're going to figure out how to orchestrate this with the mayor. Because we had to have the mayor support. And in the end, reluctantly, he did give his support to let the CTA allow us to do that.
All right.
So that was the tube money.
Yeah.
The next thing was the money for the tech park. I mean, I did a bunch of things in between then. I got a lot of money from the state to support our work in higher energy physics research, accelerator research, $2.5 million a year from Governor Ryan. We got $1.5 million a year for several years to support the Center for Food Safety Center. And then I started when earmarks were allowed again in Washington, I started to steadily get earmarks for research centers here on campus. And mm-hmm. the big thing, though, was getting that $12 million for the incubator from Governor Ryan. So in 1999, he started the program. And then in 2001, his last year, he came up with this, 2001, he came, because he was planning to run for governor again. Mm-hmm. He hadn't been taken down yet. He was just going poo-poo about these people, mm-hmm. you know, this Patrick Fitzgerald coming after him.
Yeah.
So he created something called Tech 2000, or Tech something like that, some fancy name. I'll remember in a second. Anyway, and the idea was to, for the millennium, to come up with a whole range of big projects, capital projects, mm-hmm. to invest in the state for its tech future.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And right along that, that's when I had been working diligently to come up with an idea for how to build a tech park, mm-hmm. with other people's money. That was my job, assigned by. When the process started for us to get to basically spin off ITRE, mm-hmm. to become a Lion, we were, part of the deal was Lou Collins was going to get a hold of those two buildings, the engineering research building, chemistry research building, which were basically empty at that time. Mm-hmm. They still had a few little ITRE projects in there, mm-hmm. and he said, "Well, you know, David, why don't we think about a tech park?" I said, "What's a tech park?" He says, "Well, you better find out because you're going to build it." And that was really a great thing for me. I mean, I just loved, like I told you, just so exciting to jump into that world. And and so I put together I gave you all that documentation. Mm-hmm. I put together this one pager that said a life sciences research center for Chicago South Side, you know. And so that was the thing that started off the money. And I got a $12 million commitment out of that Tech 2000 initiative of spring of 2001. And then with that, you know, we got our first $5 million, and we built the, that was perfect alignment with the decision of the university and our strategic plan of 2001 to start to expand biomedical engineering and create an academic program. So it was basically just a research program. Mm-hmm. And so that was the time when we hired Vince Torito, and we hired a bunch of new faculty, but they didn't have research labs. So this tech park was the way of getting high-quality research labs in place for all this new faculty we were hiring.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay.
And the university put in, but in, we couldn't do it all with the state money, so the university had to put in $5 million for these labs, mm-hmm. because we were required by the State Historic Preservation Agency to restore the entire facade of the west side of the engineering research building. It had to put in, re-window it whole. So the window had been taken out, mm-hmm. and it was all bricked up. So in order to get the $12 million, we ended up having to commit to do the windows, and you couldn't use state money for replacement windows at that time for some stupid reason. But nonetheless, it was appropriate for the university to spend that money, because it was not for the we were able to get the incubator started, because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. we had to rebuild the whole north end, the whole mm-hmm. northern third of the incubator building. Mm-hmm. to get the labs in there, mm-hmm. and do all new air handling equipment and everything else. So they're beautiful labs, but the west side is all university research labs, and so in effect their $5 million paid for that.
All right.
And then Governor Blagojevich came in, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the state started to go into, you know, chaotic condition, and I hired a new lobbyist to work with the governor, mm-hmm. one of his closest friends, you know, former staff, chief of staff when he was a congressman, mm-hmm. and he worked with me to try to get the rest of the money, mm-hmm. and I got all but $1.3 million of that 12, right. and then everything stopped,
right.
and we were stuck, and we spent the money. I had recommended the university that we go ahead and, you know, front end the money, because I'm sure we're going to get the money, but then it became less and less likely we're going to get the money. It mm-hmm. wasn't until Governor Quinn came in. Mm-hmm. and that we actually got that final payment.
All right. So Blagojevich is in for about 6 years. So during those 6 years, the state is just increasingly not a resource?
He didn't have the money. You know, it was all, he frittered it away or something. I don't know. Just, mm-hmm. you know, I tried to get all that $12 million out when
Ryan was
governor, and I couldn't get it done. Mm-hmm. I tried to get down 101 and 02, and I got 1 million in 01 and 5 million in 02, and then it stopped. So I left 6 million on the table. But then I got all but a million, like I said, 1.3 million from the Blagojevich administration. All right. So I was able to rough in the south end incubator. The middle had been redone for university research labs meanwhile. Hmm. So we had got a huge amount of benefit from that for university research labs. Then we're sitting on the roughed in south end, which I decided to make it two levels instead of one. Hmm. So it costs more money. And that's when, in 2009, the stimulus program came along.
All right. Hmm. Okay. All right.
And so I was able to, working with our team here, we were able to convince the Economic Development Administration to invest $4 million in there. And I got another $2 million from the state that time to finish the incubator, which is now a fabulous thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And that was, you know, running parallel to that, the whole was the work on the getting the metro stop.
Yeah.
Which actually started when I first started going to Washington in the middle 90s, when I found out that Congress in Russia was as interested as we were in getting that metro stop. And so that took all the way till 2002. We finally got it in the federal transportation bill, a line item for $5 million, which then President Bush cut to $4 million. And so then we were stuck with $4 million and a good idea. And Metra agreed to put in a fifth of that, so they were going to put in $1 million. So we had $5 million, and then that was enough to design the metro stop, and that was like 2006, 2007, and the price comes back $12 million. So the question, where are you going to go for that money? And lo and behold, that was also paid for by the stimulus program. So we have a total of about $11.5 million in federal stimulus money in one block. Between the metro stop and the incubator, across the street from each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And you ran into a little bit of unexpected controversy with the metro station.
Yeah,
right?
You know about that.
Yeah,
God knows. You're talking about the student, the master's degree student in College of Architecture that decided to raise the hue and cry that we were destroying the Meese Building, which plans
for the media, right?
the little box,
yeah,
the little
right. Yeah.
Box.
That?
Well,
do you remember that?
And Blair Kamen wrote an article and said, you know what, even if it is his building, every once in a while, if it's just a fingerprint, or his fingerprints are on the building, it's completely undistinguished and doesn't really add anything to his work. And you know what I found out afterwards? That the architecture faculty knew it wasn't his building, and they never came into my defense.
Really? Interesting. Do you think the relationships that you had forged previously with Blair Kamen kind of...
I don't know about that. No, because I really had been silent. This was like, you know, 4 or 5, 7 years later. But it was his respect for the university at the time. We had nothing but good stuff from him on most of the stuff that we'd done. So one wonders.
Yeah.
But it was a good saving grace for him.
We've got about 3-4 minutes to go. Do you want to do a little bit more chronological stuff, or would you want a philosophic question?
Yeah, maybe philosophic questions. Yeah, why don't we do that?
Yeah, well, what do you think is your biggest achievement here?
Well, I'd split, you know, there's three things that I remember, and so when you ask me for the biggest thing, it's hard to say. You know, number one, obviously, is the tube, because that thing was the most crazy thing you could ever imagine anybody ever asking state government to fund. You know, think about it, right? And getting it through the CTA. Combined with that, though, in terms of impact, would be getting the state to pay orchestrating the process to get the city to pay the $7 million for the landscaping and using our plans getting the lane out of State Street, you know, rebuilding State Street and 33rd Street and then doing all landscaping. You remember we took a lane out of each side of State Street to create a much more attractive middle of campus.
Yeah.
And the third, then, obviously, is the tech park. You know, that the lasting legacy, because the tech park basically, and probably it's the biggest thing, and people will never recognize it, but what it basically did is it enabled the university to occupy the south end of campus, whereas up until 2004, nobody wanted to be, from the university, wanted to be in the south end of campus. And that, combined with the CHA plan for transformation and the taking down the public housing and getting the police headquarters, allowed us to imagine being taking, you know, reclaiming a third of the campus that we couldn't have because Intry was also here. I'm going to pick those three big things, you know, because those are lasting legacies. I mean, you know, frankly, the Metro stop is a good story, but it was really Congressman Rush that mainly did that. Yeah.
Right. Well, final question in the last minute or so. Is there any story that you feel you should tell in that brief amount of time that's not going to be represented in the written record, in the papers that you turn over?
Boy, that's a hard question. Because my papers may have some version of everything in it. One story I was reminded of yesterday when I was talking with IA was the story of Charlie Shaw's involvement in getting the tech park done. And Charlie was such a great guy, wonderful human being, and a board member. And he was picked by Lou Collins, because of his experience, to be our advisor on getting the tech park deal done with the private developer. Because the tech park never would have happened beyond the incubator if I didn't have a private developer partner. Mm-hmm. And they paid the great bulk of the money in the park. And Charlie had, his special experience was that he had done the tech park for Northwestern and then got basically screwed by the president of Northwestern after he'd done the first building, and the president withdrew his support for the university, for the next president withdrew his support. So Charlie said, David, the one thing I'm going to tell you is don't screw this developer. You know, he's going to put a lot of money into this thing. And so he encouraged us to agree with the developer to put in a paragraph that said, you know, we need to keep, this part of campus has to have a tech park associated with it. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's in there. We'll see how long that lasts, you know. It's a 55-year ground lease. So it's written into the ground lease.
All right.
We'll see how long that lasts. But Charlie was great in that way. And then he died unexpectedly in a skiing accident several years later. In a skiing accident several years later. So that's the one one little story I always remember.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's lots of other crazy things that have gone on, Lou Collins calling me in 1996 when I was out with my family celebrating my mother's 80th birthday. He calls back and says, David, you got to come back to campus. We got a gang war that's broken down the south end of campus in those projects. I said, what am I going to do? You know?
Right, yeah.
He said, well, do something. So I called the chief of staff and said, God, please, please, Gary, can't you do something to stop them from shooting at us? You know, God knows.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably enough. You know, who knows? If there are other questions are raised by this conversation, please don't hesitate to get back to me.
Well, sure. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for taking time out of your day to talk to us.
I'm sure there's a lot of other stuff. I could tell you all the stories of the accreditation process, but.
Well, if you want to give us another 2-hour block, just so you know where to find us in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I'm probably pretty exhausted right now, but.
All